This is Dharma Podcast at dharmapodcast.org. This is show number 1098. It was recorded on March 26th, 2015, and it is part 2 of a multi-part series titled Being Completely Human. This episode is titled The First Noble Task, Embracing Dukkha or the Whole of Life. The speaker for this episode is Stephen Batchelor.
So this first presentation of four will be called Embrace Life. I suspect some of you, if not all of you, are familiar with my ideas that I've been developing in talks and in my writings over the last few years. And I'm not going to go into a great deal of technical background, citing lots of Pali texts during this retreat. If you want to get that information, I suggest you listen to the podcasts from the retreat I gave here at Upaya last June. Also, my essay, which is published online, called A Secular Buddhism, as well as a number of chapters in my last book, Confession of a Buddhist Atheist. This will be further developed upon in a somewhat more academic presentation in my forthcoming book, After Buddhism, which will be published in October. So I've got that out of the way. I want to focus for the next 4 days on how we might practice these ideas. I also want to suggest that the lady who described herself as the passenger in the sidecar, I'm also going to assume is the map reader. And I will look to her for guidance if I take a wrong turn or an unnecessary digression.
It's a pleasure to
correct you. Thank you. My sense is that what was original and distinctive in what the Buddha taught was not something that he encouraged or expected his followers to believe, but rather he encouraged his followers to do. In rather more technical language, I understand the Dharma to be a task-based ethics rather than a truth-based metaphysics. When Buddhism, of any of its schools, begins to crystallize into an orthodoxy or a rather top-heavy institution of some kind or another, that tends to be a kind of drift towards a truth-based metaphysics. In other words, this tradition has found the truth, and we are the authorities who will explain to you the practices that will allow you to experience that truth. However helpful that might be, I want to keep shifting back the other way, to think of the Dharma as first and foremost a practice, a set of tasks that do not require that we hold any a priori beliefs about the nature of reality, the nature of the self, the nature of consciousness, but rather these practices are concerned with how we respond to, how we come to terms with the experience that we are undergoing here and now. When we were sitting in meditation, closed our eyes, became conscious of our innermost feelings, our thoughts, often very difficult to articulate and to define, present to us in moods, sensations in our body, aware also of the wider world that is open to us through our relationships, through our sensory encounters with life. How do we respond to that? How do we respond authentically and truly and in an engaged way to what life brings up into our consciousness from moment to moment? And such a practice is not reducible to becoming proficient in certain meditation techniques, although I do feel that competence in meditation is very important, but it is a means to an end. And that end is not how good we are at being mindful or how still we can get in concentration, but how on such a basis we can respond appropriately to the situation at hand. One of the great masters of the Chan tradition, or Chan Son Zen tradition, was the 9th century teacher Yunmen. In Japanese, he's known as Umon. And Umon was once asked, "What is the teaching of an entire lifetime?" And his response was, "An appropriate statement." Now that, I find, gets the point exactly. There are no highest teachings of Buddhism. There are no doctrines or philosophies that somehow stand above the others as more true or more profound or whatever. What matters is whether your response to the situation at hand is appropriate or not. And that calls for a degree of utter openness to unconditionally regard what's going on, and an imagination, a creativity, a courage to respond. Now, this process is described in an acronym that I've invented called ELSA. Capital E, capital L, capital S, capital A. Embrace, let go, stop, and act. Embrace the situation, let go of your instinctive reactivity, experience the stopping of that reactivity, and then acting, whether that's in thought, in word, in deed, in work. That summarizes for me what are traditionally called the Four Noble Truths. I'm not going to mention the Four Noble Truths again. I'm going to think of them as four tasks: embracing, letting go, stopping, and acting. And in the afternoon sessions, as we mentioned last night, We're going to reflect on how those four tasks are embedded in the four vows. So this morning, I want to look in more detail from a practical point of view. What does it actually mean to embrace life? I'm going to unpack that. And being a bit of a scholar, I'm going to go back to the term we find in the early discourses of the Buddha that Gautama himself coined to describe this. The phrase he used is dukkha parinya. Dukkha parinya. Dukkha is a term, I'm sure. Parinya, P-A-R-I-N-N-A. And above the N's a little Spanish squiggle, whatever you call it. Dukkha parinya. Now, very literally, this means a dukkha, a term most of us are probably familiar with, and which is usually translated, not incorrectly, as suffering. Pari, the prefix of the verb, means quite literally around something. If you've ever done a circumambulation of Mount Kailash or some other sacred site, it's called a parikrama, which means walking around, circumambulare, ambulation. Pari means around. And nya means to know. Now, possibly the closest, most literal word in English is comprehend, which means the same thing. Com, around, prehendere, to ascertain, to grasp, to know. So dukkha parinya means to fully know suffering. But we have to unpack that. There's an enormous amount of confusion around the meaning of this word, dukkha. It's often used to argue that Buddhism, like many of the Indian ascetic traditions, of which in some sense it was a part historically, considered the world to be nothing but a vale of tears, to be a place of suffering, of pain, of distress, of anguish. And nirvana, which was the goal not just of the Buddhists, but of the Jains and others, was the stopping or the cessation of that anguish and that misery. Now, to me, that's already shifted into a kind of metaphysics. The origin of suffering is said to be craving, and the cessation of suffering is nirvana. And if we believe that, then we can consider ourselves to be Buddhists. Let's shift back towards practice. We can put all of that aside and instead try to understand what dukkha means here and now, what dukkha means as a way of getting a handle on that dimension of experience that we seek to embrace. Fortunately, we find in a very early discourse in the Samyutta Nikaya, the connected discourses in Pali, a very succinct definition by the Buddha of what dukkha refers to in this context and what comprehending or embracing means. Dukkha here refers quite clearly to the totality of our experience. It refers to our physical embodiment. It refers to everything that we see and hear and smell and taste and touch. It refers to our consciousness, our perception, our awareness of what's going on. It refers to how we feel about what's happening. It refers to how we incline ourselves to react or to respond to how we feel. All of that is covered by the word dukkha. Now, although the word dukkha means pain, very literally, even in modern Hindi, the word for pain is dukkha. But it's being used as a kind of shorthand. The Buddha's not interested in making dogmatic statements. Life is suffering. We can try not to think in that way, but rather to ask, in what way is our experience now characterized by this strange term, dukkha? One of the English words that I think captures this most succinctly is the word poignancy. There is something poignant about life. Even at moments when we are feeling content and happy, maybe even blissfully alive, there is nonetheless something poignant about that moment. And that poignancy is that implicit intuition or awareness that it won't last, that it will fade, that it will slip away. And that doesn't deny its joyfulness or its beauty. If anything, it enhances it. When I arrived in Santa Fe, I was immediately struck by all of the blossoming trees. And this is, again, very much part of East Asian aesthetics. Japan, we know they go out and look at the cherry blossoms. And the beauty of the cherry blossom lies in the very fact that it is so ephemeral. It is so much just of the moment. Even now, I was out in the backyard of where I'm staying, the already withering blossoms lying on the ground. Or the autumn leaves. It's the same thing. The beauty lies inescapably in the ephemerality of what's happening. So to make the claim that this is suffering is really rather meaningless. There's something poignant about it, and that poignancy is what gives it its depth, its luster, its beauty. It's what stops the mind. It opens the mind. In a more personal sense, let's say in a human relationship, the friendship, whether someone we love romantically or one of our family members, a child or a beloved grandparent, to fully embrace that other person is also to accept the fact that their life rests upon a single breath, as does mine. By focusing on the transient, impermanent nature of others and ourselves. We're not affirming some kind of pessimistic, oh, everything ends, it's all gloomy and miserable. But the very opposite. We're becoming acutely aware of the preciousness of that life, of the extraordinary fact that we breathe at all. So when we meditate on the breath, for example, we're meditating on that very possibility of an organism to be here at all, to hear, to smell, to see, to taste, to feel, to think. It all is made possible by an extraordinarily complex but fragile and vulnerable set of conditions which are in the end just flesh. The pumping of the heart is the pumping of a muscle. The firing of neurons in our brains is all nothing more than what has emerged from a fertilized ovum that's split into cells and has manifest in this extraordinary moment we are sharing together right now. And this leads to an inescapable awareness that life, in all of its aspects, contains a tragic dimension. But tragedy, too, is not depressing or miserable. Tragedy is what gives life a sense of depth. And if we deepen that sense of depth, it leads us into the experience of wonder, the experience of mystery, the experience of the sublime. There's something excessive about what's going on. Excessive in the sense that it exceeds our capacity for representation. It stops the mind's chatter and pettiness. For me, this is really what lies at the heart of meditation, opening our mind, opening our heart to this miraculous complexity and fragility in order to get out of the mechanical, the repetitive, the often somewhat neurotic cycling of thoughts that just repeats, repeats, repeats without really getting anywhere. So that is how I would understand dukkha. And at this point, I would almost prefer not to translate it. And if I were to translate it, I'd be tempted, even though this is not a literal translation, to render the word dukkha as life. And in English, we do use the word in this way. You know, if something, if somebody loses a job or if somebody something, you know, unpleasant happens in the course of one's life, very often we'll say, well, that's life. And when we say, well, that's life, we're saying, well, that's the nature of our existence on this earth. This is what happens. We don't get what we want. We get what we don't want, which again are phrases that the Buddha used in his definition of dukkha. And that's life. So when we use the word life in that way, I think it communicates rather well the sense of dukkha. So if that is life, how do we embrace it? What does it mean to fully know that? The key lies in the prefix fully. Because we all know that we're going to get sick, we're going to get old, we're going to die. We all know that things are going to happen that we don't like, that we're not going to get what we want. That's not exactly big news. But clearly such knowing, just having that level of knowledge or information, is not what's meant here. How do we take that rather banal recognition of the nature of life and translate it into something that engages us in the depths of ourselves? When the Buddha defines fully knowing, he defines it as the ending of greed, the ending of hatred, and the ending of delusion. The ending of greed, the ending of hatred, and the ending of delusion. Now that might strike us at first glance as being a rather odd definition of comprehending something. How do you comprehend something in terms of it being the ending of three things? This is a very, very crucial point I'm making here, and we're going to return to it throughout the rest of our time together. So to comprehend implies that this is a kind of knowing in which certain kinds of reactive, habitual behaviors are not operative. This is a knowing that's not determined by what we want, greed. It's a knowing that's not determined by what we fear or dislike, hatred. And it's a kind of knowing that's not determined by our opinions, by our views, by our prejudices, by our biases, which goes under the loose rubric of delusion. It's a kind of knowing that is free from such conditions. And in that sense, it's sometimes called unconditioned. Not unconditioned in a metaphysical sense, like God, but unconditioned by three very specific kinds of reactivity. Buddhism, I think, is often confusing for us because its language is often phrased negatively, as in this case, the ending of greed, ending of hatred, etc. But what I learned from my Tibetan teacher when I was first studying Buddhism, that this privative not doesn't mean simply the absence of, it means very often the opposite of. So when in classical Buddhist teaching they talk of the three roots of virtue, they talk of them as not greed, not hatred, not delusion. And that sounds just very negative, just an absence of those things. But how can a mere absence of something be a virtue? What it refers to is the opposite of those qualities. So not greed is something like equanimity. Not hatred is something like love or tolerance. Not delusion is something like clarity or intelligence. And here I think we can now get a clearer sense of what we mean by comprehension or embracing or fully knowing. It would be something like a lucid, tolerant, loving equanimity. And this, I think, is a pretty good definition of a meditative or a contemplative sensibility. A contemplative sensibility is one characterized by a certain a calm and balance, equanimity. When we settle in meditation, we find that space within us that is not being pushed and pulled by our likes and dislikes. It also has a degree of detachment, not disassociation, but detachment in the sense of being free from those pushes and pulls of our instinctive habitual reactions. It's also a frame of mind in which we're able to accept things as they are. And this acceptance, I think, is very much at the root of mindfulness and awareness, in which we're able to tolerate what's going on. We're able to say, yes, although this is a very painful moment, I can open myself to it and say, yes. This is this feeling of pain, of distress, of anguish, of grief, is a natural consequence of the circumstances of my life that have led me to this point. And in embracing life, I need to find that capacity within myself. I'm not saying this is easy. And this, I think, is very much what meditative practice is about, is being able to get to that core of our being where we can say, in spite of everything, I say yes. This is what is happening. This is my life at this moment. This is not, however, resignation. This is very important. Nor is it indifference. But again, we'll come back and explain that more clearly as we proceed. And also as we cultivate a contemplative life, we learn to become more still within ourselves by paying attention, by focusing our minds more clearly on the detail, the specifics of each moment. That also cultivates and enhances a clarity of mind. I'm sure all of us who have done meditation for any length of time have had this experience that after, say, an hour on the cushion or a day in retreat, we walk out of the zendo into the garden and the world is more radiant. There's a kind of luminous quality, even when the sun is not shining like today. There's a kind of, the colors seem almost enriched. The sounds seem that much more vibrant and more subtle. And this is the opposite of what we technically call delusion. The mind becomes more limpid, more focused, and more clear. So to embrace life is very much about learning to cultivate this open-hearted, radiant, equanimous stillness, attention, and clarity. And that's what we seek to practice, not only in formal meditation, but also in what is sometimes called meditation in daily life. I think the word meditation here sometimes becomes a bit of a problem. Because what, as soon as we use the word meditation, it's very difficult not to think of it as a particular exercise of some kind or another. Contemplation, I think, is sometimes a better term, and contemplative is a term that I think captures this quite well. How do we live a more contemplative life? And this transcends our proficiency in a particular meditative skill. And it points rather to the emergence of a sensibility. Meditation in daily life, I would like to think of as the cultivation over time of a contemplative sensibility. And this is something that's not reducible to techniques of any kind. It has to do with how in our life as a whole, we begin to relate to the world and to ourselves and to others from a somewhat different perspective. Not the perspective of me and what I want and what I don't want. In other words, the story that the ego runs in our ongoing monologue in our heads. But suspending that, not suppressing it, becoming aware of the limitations of that kind of behavior, we slowly open up to a more contemplative relationship to the world as such. So that is a broad sketch of what it means to embrace life, to comprehend what's going on. But I think we can tease it out even further. Such an embrace involves different dimensions of knowing. One of these dimensions is cognitive. And the practice of vipassana, not only in the Theravada tradition, or the Tibetan tradition says much the same thing, but also we find this very clearly stated in the early texts, which are pre-Orthodox, before they became Buddhism. That vipassana means literally to see intensely or to see penetratingly. And that penetrative vision pays attention to certain features of our experience that we habitually deny or ignore. And those elements are traditionally threefold. We tend to deny or ignore the impermanence of things, and instead we insist on finding something permanent and lasting. We tend to deny or ignore the tragic dimension of experience, and instead insist on trying to fit the world or manipulate the world in such a way that it accords to what we want, that it fits our fantasy of a perfect situation. And we tend to ignore that the experience of life is not inherently me or mine. It is not me, not mine. And yet we're very invested in wanting to control our lives in such a way that we can feel secure in who I am and we can feel secure in what I have, what I possess, whether that's material goods, whether it's other people, whether it's our social position or whatever. So the practice of penetrating insight, of vipassana, is the practice of undermining those habits. And the way that's done is not by suppressing them or rejecting them, but it's by cultivating an attention to what they block out. So we start paying systematic attention to the impermanent character of experience. Now, in some ways, this, again, seems rather self-evident. We know that things change. But again, it's not that kind of simple intellectual knowledge. It's learning to train the attention so that it's not just that we know that things change, but we feel that change in our bones. We become increasingly sensitized to the shifting, mutating, transient nature of what's going on. One of the meditations that I found most effective training as a Tibetan Buddhist monk was the meditation on death. Again, we all know that we're going to die, but we've not really internalized that knowing to the point where it becomes a kind of felt sense, a deep intuition, a sensibility, a keen feel for our own mortality. So every day for many years, for at least half an hour, I was instructed to attend to the certainty of death, as death being the only thing that's certain in the future. Nothing else is. Everything we plan for may not happen. But one thing will happen, and that is that we will stop breathing and we will die. The time, the uncertainty of the time of death. Although death is certain, its time is utterly uncertain. We all have friends, relatives, our own age, who are no longer with us. And it's helpful, I think, at times to bring those departed people to mind and to ask ourselves, how am I different from them? We have this naive sense that death is something that only happens to other people, which in some ways is true. Because when it happens to us, we're no longer aware that it's happened. But this contemplation of the certainty of death and the uncertainty of its time leads to a question, an ethical question. If that is really the case, that this might be my last day, month, year on earth, then what do I do? How do I live? What really matters? What is it that is of deepest importance to me in this life? It's an ethical question. And the contemplation of death forces us to think more ethically. By ethics, by the way, I don't mean morality. I mean it in the classical Greek sense of what constitutes a good and flourishing life. That is the practice of ethics. It entails morality, but it's not reducible to it. It's not about, you know, not doing some things and doing other things because a religion or a philosophy has deemed this to be good and that to be bad. It has to do deep down with how I, as an individual, my community, how can we optimally flourish? How can we live most fully? And what we do to enable that flourishing is the practice of ethics. So this cultivation of this penetrating insight or attention is cognitive. We're learning to know the changing, tragic, selfless nature of our lives, but to know it in such a way that that awareness infuses our consciousness as a whole, that that awareness somehow becomes embodied. And frankly, my experience of Buddhist meditation over these years has, I think, led me to a sensitivity to these things that is very much constitutive of how I feel pretty much all the time. It's always difficult to judge one's own inner changes because you're the one who's undergoing them. But if anything, I feel that these practices of contemplation reorient one's primary sensibility to one's experience of being human, of being perhaps more wholly or fully human. Another dimension of this embracing or comprehending has to do with cultivating a quality of questioning and not knowing, rather than always trying to consolidate and justify one's beliefs and opinions. Such a contemplative relationship to life is open to a kind of humility that basically, despite all the views and opinions I might have about human life, consciousness, reality, whatever it is, at some level of true honesty, I have to acknowledge that I don't really know. That life is overwhelmingly strange. And we tend to block that out too. It's not comfortable. We like to find consolation in certainties. And religions and political parties are very much in the business of providing us with the consolation of certainty. It makes us feel much more secure. Yet when we start engaging, say, in Zen practice, that particular consolation quickly goes out the window. That we are challenged to open ourselves to the uncertainty of life. We're challenged to repeatedly ask questions like, what is this? What is this? E mo ko in Korean. And not just to ask this as some sort of moment of curiosity, but to ask it, as it says in one Chinese text, with the marrow of our bones and the pores of our skin. To ask it to the point where the words of the koan fall away, and one is left with what is called the sensation of great doubt. Now, again, this kind of practice requires a certain discipline in contemplative practice. You can't just switch it on. In the count of three, we're all going to experience the great doubt. It doesn't work like that. It's something that needs to be cultivated. And the flip side of questioning, the flip side of what is this, is I don't know. The famous don't know mind. Because clearly, whenever we sincerely ask a question, we are tacitly acknowledging that we don't know something. If we knew it, we wouldn't ask the question. So this is both an affirmation of this doubt or this questioning. What is this? But it's also an affirmation of that felt sense of, I don't know what this is. My own practice, and by that I mean my own formal meditation practice, is basically a hybrid of the Vipassana, paying mindful attention to impermanence and dukkha and not self, and at the same time allowing that to open up the question of what is this then? Of not thinking of impermanence and dukkha and not self as kind of dogmatic facts that I can know, but rather as ways of stripping off the certainty of permanence and well-being and me. And when those certainties begin to be eroded and begin to fall away, then what opens up is also a deeper sense of the sheer strangeness of life itself. A strangeness in which we find, hopefully, the humility to acknowledge that I don't know what this is, and to rest in that. So there's a sense, therefore, that this embracing of life is also an openness to be able to question life and to embrace its strangeness and its mystery. But there's another dimension too. There's actually at least two more dimensions I'm going to try and talk about before we finish. This knowing is also, this embracing of life is also, has an empathetic dimension. It's not just about knowing, it's not just about being in a state of wonder, but it's also about the cultivation of an empathetic heart. When self-centeredness, when our clinging to permanence, to me, to my happiness, when that begins to break down, it also opens us unavoidably, I would argue, to a greater empathetic responsiveness to the suffering, to the lives of others. I think this attachment to ego is in many ways a kind of defense mechanism, a kind of anesthetic in which we can somehow feel numb to the pain of the other. It's very easy to be empathetic with those who we consider to be within our realm of what belongs to me, my family, my friends, my fellow Buddhists, my fellow Americans, my fellow whatever. But we usually draw a line at a certain point in which, beyond which lies those we exclude. And human beings are very, I think, almost programmed to live within a zone that includes those we feel are part of my world or my society, my family, and thereby to exclude those others who are not. And we only have to read the newspapers to see who's excluded. The Islamists, the communists, and so on and so forth. So this practice of letting go of that holding on to me and mine is also an opening of the heart to all beings who have been born, who live, grow old, and die on this earth. Not just humans. Buddhism is not a humanism. I think we have to be very clear about that. Buddhism is a sentient being-ism. And right from the very beginning of the tradition, the Buddha speaks of sabbasatta, all beings. We cultivate loving kindness and compassion and bodhicitta, not to all humanity, but to all beings. all things that live and breathe and feel as we also feel, who have longings, who have fears, however primitive they may be in relation to, say, the complexity of the human organism, they nonetheless feel. They avoid things that threaten them, and they are drawn to things that offer them sustenance and well-being. So this practice of, so this contemplative sensibility is very much a reorienting of our primary empathetic identification with all that lives. And again, there are many exercises in Buddhist traditions that cultivate these feelings. But finally, it's not so much those explicit practices that will count. It has to do more with the organic emergence of a sensibility that is deep within us. And that as we sit on the cushion, as we walk through the streets of our local town, this sensibility begins to resonate, not just within us, but within all of the connections and contacts we have with those we encounter, those we meet, those we have conflicts with, those we fall in love with. All of this is involved. And one final dimension of this sensibility that has to do with embracing life is a dimension that's not spoken so much about in traditional Buddhist teaching, and that is the aesthetic dimension. I understand this embracing of life as involving a cognitive transformation, an affective transformation, and an aesthetic transformation. I've already touched on this at the beginning with the mention of the cherry blossoms, of how meditation and stillness and clarity make the world more radiant, more beautiful, more sublime, all of which are aesthetic qualities. The idea of poignancy, likewise, is very often has something very aesthetic about it. There's a beauty in what is poignant. And although Buddhism doesn't speak a great deal about aesthetics, it's certainly a tradition that has generated some of the world's greatest works of art. We see them here. We see this architectural principles that underpin the beauty of this room and this center. But clearly, art and aesthetics is not an exclusively Buddhist concern. We come from a tradition in the West that has an extraordinarily rich history and practice of the arts. And I personally find an enormous inspiration in my own practice through art. And by that I mean literature, poetry, theatre, film, all of the artistic disciplines. I know it can sometimes seem a bit precious to talk of great art as opposed to art of a somewhat supposedly inferior quality, but I don't want to get into that. What matters really is, does a work of art move us deeply in such a way that it enhances the sensibility that we cultivate in our practice? And I think most works that I would consider to be great art and I'll list, you know, Rembrandt and Beethoven and Shakespeare, but also a great deal of contemporary art as well, I find actually helps illuminate from an aesthetic perspective impermanence, the tragic dimension of dukkha, the impersonal nature of experience, in a way that brings a very important and I think often overlooked dimension to the contemplative life. Take one of Shakespeare's tragedies, for example, Lear or Macbeth or Hamlet. People without any particular religious or spiritual philosophy are drawn to these works. And when we find ourselves watching a performance of one of these plays, we're not looking at a screwball romantic comedy that makes us laugh, that's entertaining, and yet we're still somehow pulled very deeply within us to this performance that illuminates the depths of human experience almost invariably in a deeply tragic way. And we don't go away feeling depressed. We go away feeling somehow enriched, that we've tapped into something deep about who we really are. So I feel that both the appreciation of art and also the doing of art, we'll come back to that on Sunday. Art as a practice, not art as something we appreciate and enjoy. But the appreciation of art is also a crucial dimension of the practice of embracing life, comprehending life. In terms of art as a way to not self, which might sound a little bit strange, what an example of that might be. There is currently at the Guggenheim in New York a show called Silence. And it's a retrospective of the work of a Japanese-American artist called On Kawara. Are you familiar with On Kawara's work? No one. He died last year. For 48 years, On Kawara painted a tablet, a canvas, which just gave the date, the month, and the year. So it would be 2 February 1982. That was it. Every day he did the same. When he traveled anywhere, he sent telegrams to his friends, to his gallery, with the simple words, "I am still alive." That's all he did. He refused to have any profile. We don't know hardly anything about the man. He didn't even attend the openings of his exhibitions. That, to me, it sounds strange, but when you walk down the Guggenheim spiral and you see the dedication in these very simple, utterly impersonal, not self indicators of days of a human life, it suddenly, or not suddenly, but it gradually illuminates your own life, that each day, and he sometimes, you know, he stored these paintings in a box with a newspaper of that day, and they've displayed the newspapers too. It's not On Kawara's thing. It tells you nothing about the artist. The artist gets out of the way to show you the world, to reveal the world. So I'm going to stop here. It's 12 o'clock. We're going to have a break for 30 minutes. We'll come back here at 12:30, and we'll conclude the morning session before lunch with another sit. Let me remind you that this is still in silence, so please don't get drawn into conversations unless they're functionally necessary. But try to just spend the next 30 minutes relaxing, having a cup of tea, whatever you need to do, but trying to just reflect and absorb whatever might have been said this morning that has somehow touched something within you. To try to spend the next time, you know, until we meet again, pondering on what this contemplative sensibility might be that would enrich and make possible this embracing of life. Thank you.